Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
And it's easy for us now to forget the centuries in which Christianity was at war with itself, whether in the suppression of heresy within states or in wars of religion between states. Christianity in its various forms was extremely toxic. And people like Locke were trying to argue a case for saying that states, political societies, should be tolerant of religion. And his is a classic text that argues that. But then we come to the slipperiness, or we come to the difficult crunch of what and where are the limits of that. Now, Locke is quite clear that whatever your beliefs, or whether you have very little belief, or whether you're Jewish or Muslim or Christian or whatever, then the state has no business poking into your beliefs and your practice and your worship. But the only ground on which the state can interfere is to protect individuals, the citizens of the state. Let me just give you a little example from Christian religion. There have been one or two cases in the United States where very deeply committed Christians have murdered abortion doctors. They believe that they are doing God's work in doing so. But of course, the state and the political society, civil society, holds that that is murder. And it's no good pleading your religious conscience in that case, because the state will step in and say, we'll draw the line there. So any time a religion produces a principle that fundamentally violates the principles of a civil society, then the state will want to step in.
Silence can be either protest or consent, but most times it's fear. The compelling words of American writer, teacher and poet Paul Beatty from his 2016 Man Booker Award-winning novel, The Sellout, published by One World Publications. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to meet with two hugely talented writers and thinkers, one a novelist and poet, the other an historian and political theorist, and tackle some of the big questions in public life. First up, it's satire, segregation, and political correctness with Paul Beatty. Paul Beatty is the first American writer to win the Man Booker Prize for his stunning fourth novel, The Sellout, a fast-paced, hilarious, kick-ass satire about US racial politics and all the dirty, ugly, messy stuff in between. Now, comic genius does not come close to describing this writer's gift for satire. Well, this week, I had the very great pleasure of talking to Paul Beatty from his home in New York.
Hi, my name's Paul Beatty. I'm a novelist, reluctant poet. I live in New York, born in Los Angeles. I'm going to read the opening paragraph of The Sellout. This may be hard to believe, coming from a black man, but I've never stolen anything, never cheated on my taxes or at cards, never snuck into the movies or failed to give back the extra change to a drugstore cashier, indifferent to the ways of mercantilism and minimum wage expectations. I have never burgled a house, held up a liquor store, never boarded a crowded bus or subway car, sat in a seat reserved for the elderly, pulled out my gigantic penis, and masturbated to satisfaction with a perverted, yet somehow crestfallen look on my face. But here I am, in the cavernous chambers of the Supreme Court of the United States of America, my car illegally and somewhat ironically parked on Constitution Avenue, my hands cuffed and crossed behind my back, my right to remain silent, long since waved and said goodbye to, as I sit in a thickly padded chair that, much like this country, isn't quite as comfortable as it looks.
Paul, really well done on the book, The Sellout. It's a remarkable read. It's very uncomfortable in parts, hilarious in other parts. It's very clever. It's very daring. It's a lot of different things, and I'm sure it will mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Mm. I might throw you a big wide open question to start off with. What does the history of America mean to you?
That is a big question. It's a good question. I mean, the history means a lot of things, you know, at different times. And I think part of it is there's so much history that, you know, that most people don't know, and there's so much history that I don't know. And there's a ton of history that we know and we just are completely uncomfortable with, you know, that we refuse to acknowledge, you know. And, I don't think that's, you know, germane to just America. I think it's how, you know, we treat history, especially in the Western world. So, it means a lot, you know. But it's one of those things that, it's just like the news cycle. It's, there's something that's of concern for 3 days, and then there's something new, is bothering you for 3 days, and you forget. Like, there's not much follow-up to American history, I guess. So it's hard for things to stay with, you know.
Now, the novel touches on some very uncomfortable truths in American history, like segregation, I suppose issues related about identity politics and culture.
Yeah.
How difficult is that to write as a novelist? Because you're touching on history, you're touching on contemporary culture, and given the last few years in American life when we've had some very difficult issues in relation to race politics, it must have been very challenging, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging. I mean, it's not the subject matter that's challenging. For me, it's just the writing that's challenging. It's the challenge of just, getting these, my insane thoughts that don't make any sense to me, those on the page, and try to keep the level of confusion, but try to have some clarity about it. So that part's tough. I mean, when I say the subject matter is not challenging, I don't want to, discount that, because it is, and I know these are things that people are sensitive about, and I'm sort of sensitive about them, but, I think, I start off by kind of ridiculing myself, as a person, as a pseudo-intellectual, as a bunch of things, so that's where I start, Yeah, and then I have, certain idealists and concepts and constructs that I just want to poke fun at and turn upside down, and I know, some of those things are going to make people uncomfortable, but, I think sometimes people are relieved, maybe it's relief, but, are just excited that somebody else is thinking about these things in these kind of roundabout ways and underhanded ways, I guess. And I don't know. I mean, people come back and they're just, I'm so glad you're talking about X, Y, and Z in this way, because, it's hard for me to talk about, to be honest. I'm not very good at being succinct about what it is that I do.
I loved the Dum Dum Donut Intellectual Club and some of the meetings that Bon Bon attends, and they're absolutely hilarious. But how far can you actually go?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone can go as far as they want to go, I mean, that's the thing I try to do in this book is I think I'd always try to do it, but I don't let somebody tell me or let myself tell myself that, I can't go there, I go there to the end that it serves the needs of the story I want to tell, and so that's, I try to write without any boundaries. Not that I don't have them, but, I try to at least pretend that I don't. And, and things like the Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals, it's, America's a place that takes itself very seriously, and it's so insecure, and it's a place that doesn't have a ton of irony about itself. And so I have fun just testing that out, and I think I just have a problem with institutions and people that take themselves seriously, even though I know I can do that, with myself sometimes. And so, so I don't want to say they're easy targets necessarily, but they're things that I enjoy, especially the intellectual class. I enjoy just, what's the UK phrase, taking the piss, I guess.
You brought up in your acknowledgements a guy called William E. Cross.
Yeah.
He was a psychologist. He did some work in relation to black identity development. I think it was the Negro to Black conversion experience.
Yeah.
I looked him up on the internet, and it's a very interesting stage process. I'm just wondering, reintroducing segregation and having the idea of black slavery, do you think by tackling that in fiction in some way that we can actually properly look at it again?
Yeah, I don't know about properly. I don't know what that means.
I think
means,
we can really actually properly look at it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, people, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not going to be proper for everybody involved, For some people, it's going to be traumatic, And, I came across that his work when I was in grad school in psychology. And for me, it was just so interesting to see somebody taking identity, which is a huge part of, psychology, and then trying to, kind of codify it to his own needs. And it was just like this ingenious way of looking at blackness that I completely disagreed with it, but, I don't have like these kind of hierarchical things about I guess when I was in school, the word that people used to throw around was consciousness all the time. Yeah, and of course I'm doing psych, but this notion of when somebody becomes consciousness, who determines when you've become conscious, was always intriguing to me. And, and there's a lot of judgment in that, to claim that someone's, doesn't think the same way you do. and then is at some level is, you know, thinking on a lesser order. And so that was just always interesting to me. But it was just interesting to see someone take the notion of black identity seriously. And, you know, and I hadn't looked at it in a long time, but then in the process of writing the book, I went to, you know, look at some of his later work, and it was just interesting how his own notions of what blackness meant had just changed over time. And then for me, it's like one of those things about just how fluid, you know, identity is, one's own identity. And I think the things that sometimes feel more inert is like our perceptions of the identity of others just sometimes seem to be really intransigent. And it's just interesting for me.
Yeah, you tackle stereotypes in a big way, all different types of cultural stereotypes in the book. And it got me thinking that, you know, there are the white stereotypes, there are the black stereotypes, but you also get, well, in genders, gender roles and so on.
Yeah.
We're all in some way playing to a stereotype. It's just that we are possibly in some way is that there is an uncomfortable history to play with here.
Yeah.
And so that layers so much that makes it so loaded, does it?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, these are artifacts that I think we're all familiar with, you know, at some level. And I think, yeah, I don't want to say that they're all the same, you know. And so for me, I always have like a lot of fun just kind of turning these things inside and out. And they're absurd, but at some level, they're so genuine. And we just kind of forget like who we are sometimes or who we can be. And yeah, and so I just kind of try to put these characters in situations where they're kind of almost making fun of themselves at the same time, you know, and embracing things that are uncomfortable about their histories, about their identity, but are nevertheless there. You know, there's this character, Hominy, in the book, who's like this quintessential, I don't know, in the States we'd call him a quintessential coon. But there's something about in his self-hatred and his self-analysis that I think is in all of us, you know, because I think a lot of the stuff in the States, you know, happening around Trump is this kind of weird kind of collective self-hatred, I think, and this collective insecurity and this collective sense of not being comfortable with their own identity. And I don't know, Hominy's not so different in a weird way. And then, you know, on the other side is in some ways he's the smartest and the bravest person in the book at the same time, you know. And role-playing's not the right word, but, you know, our societal roles. You know, I think a lot of this comes out of my psych background, and I just love teasing these things out, you know, who belongs where. You know, some of the book is about how do you navigate Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is a city that who you are, what you look like, what you drive, you know, is so much about your identity, how you see yourself, how others see you, and it's also a city that, you know, kind of self-segregates, like, you know, you grow up learning, oh, I can't cross this street for any number of reasons. So it's an interesting way of, like, how you also police yourself, you know, and kind of, you know, build your own fences about where you can trespass and where you can't. And so the book's about that in some ways.
You have a lovely line about closure in the book, and you were comparing, you know, how we look at our history and what's happened in our own personal narratives or lies, and you compared the idea of closure to erasure. And you say the problem with closure is that once you have a taste of it, you want it in everything or every bleeding aspect of your life. And it's very, very true. But we can't ever really have total closure.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe death or something. I don't know. But even that... is a total closure, I think, in a lot of ways. Yeah, no, it's you know, it's one of those words and one of those concepts that we have been, you know, socialized to believe in a weird way. And, you know, I think people want closure about things that make them feel uncomfortable. So, you know, some people want closure about race because they're just tired of talking about it and it makes them feel uncomfortable. And, you know, Obama's president, hence it's done. You know, Theresa May's prime minister, hence we don't need to talk about these things anymore. You know, and it's, you know, closure serves a purpose.
It's so bloody appealing, but, you know, it's when you think it through, it's so unbelievably unrealistic.
Yeah.
When I read the book, I was going through a pretty tough time and I had a house flood and a roof falling in on me. And I was feeling like the world was really kicking in at me in some way. So reading The Sellout, and it's got a lot of energy and it's got a lot of bite. And as I said earlier, there's lots of uncomfortable moments in it. But it is quite a tonic in another way, because you're really putting it to the reader and you're really going hard at it. which is very refreshing in these politically correct times.
Yeah.
And you write, people eat the shit you shovel them.
Mm.
I laughed my head off, but it's true, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's often, I mean, it's hard not to go day to day with having just, you can't, it's hard to question everything, you know? And yeah, it just reminds me of these old Preston Sturges movies where he's always talking about like art versus commerce and, you know, and just like, these are just things that I think about, and it's hard for me to, you know, put everything in there, but I try. I mean, I know one of our problems is that, you know, we adapt sometimes so easily, and we accept things so easily. God, I'm sounding like some kind of anarchist from the 19-teens or something, but, you know, and every now and then you kind of realize that, you know, you don't want to adapt, you don't fit in, or you're pretending, and sometimes you have to make a decision about what to do. It's like we were talking about consciousness earlier, and there's a thing about, you know, I think it's different for everyone, but it's when you feel yourself becoming conscious, it puts some choices in front of you that aren't very easy about, you know, do you fight back, do you acquiesce, do you just know and you swallow it, and you were talking about, like, you know, these changing times, and the times are changing, but all this stuff has been there, you know, and for whatever reason, it's, you know, bubbled to the surface. You know, this hatred, this insecurity, this fear, this anger, none of it's new, but, you know, every now and then things happen and you feel like you have to start taking sides. And I think one of the things that might be happening in the States is people are conscious that they might have to start taking sides. You know, there are plenty of people who know what side they're on, but it's also the notion of, beyond taking sides, you might have to take some action. And very few people do. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. I'm sorry, I'm rambling.
I might throw you a philosophical question if it's okay.
But
do you think America will ever become a post-race society? Do you whatever the word means in its own right, do you think that can ever exist?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think things become post anything ever.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not about just race necessarily. It's about post anything. I mean, you know, it's like looking at the UK still royalist at some level, you know? These things stay with us for a long time, and they manifest themselves in ways that we don't always recognize, you know? I mean, you know, people are not very nice to each other. God, I sound like a simpleton, which I can be. But, you know, I think, you know, division is just a part of how we live life,
yeah.
You know? And the thing is, you know, thank goodness there are people who just don't tolerate it and who will discuss it and who fight back and or write poems about it, whatever they decide to do, you know. And, you know, they make us, you know, examine who we are and how we operate. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, who knows what will happen. And it depends what you mean by these things. I think part of it is these phrases get thrown out, post-racial, or like the idea of what political correctness is or what feminism is. And these terms get hijacked. And they get used in ways that are self-serving.
And it's thrown out in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, you're giving lots of different readings. You're the first American to win the Booker Prize.
Yeah.
And I imagine life is very busy at the moment. But depending on what location you are in America or what suburb and what bookshop you're reading, you're going to either have a lot of black readers there or a lot of white readers there. And I'm wondering, in what ways have people, you rub people up in different ways, because there's, you know, offense operates on so many different levels. So
yeah.
I'm just wondering, some people just don't want things put in their face.
Yeah, no, those people probably won't, won't buy the book. Yeah, I don't really think too much. Like, I don't write. I'm not writing to anyone, you know. And when I show up, like, the readings are different, but it's not so much about black and white. Sometimes it's about age, it's about where, it's about what happened in the news beforehand. You know, I'm just happy to have people in there that are reading and thinking. And, you know, sometimes it's about the mood that I'm in. You know, I teach, and I had an ex-student write me this long email the other day, and he was thinking about the book and the part where the father is doing these social experiments on his son. And he was talking about when he first read it, like how he found it, like, just completely hilarious. You know, that's where he was operating from. But for him, since Trump's election, he said he reread the book, and, like, that scene means it's still funny, but so serious now.
It cuts to it, doesn't it, really?
You know, he sees, oh, God, this guy's actually trying to protect his son, but he has no idea how to do it. Like, he's got this whole thing. And so, yeah, I mean, for me, it was nice to hear that because that's what I'm trying to do. It's like these two sides about, like, the book is funny and it's not funny. The book is serious and not serious, you
know.
And so
it struck me as I was reading through, and as you progress through the novel, it's deeply sad in lots of different ways in some of the relationships and structures around those. There's a massive amount of emptiness and loneliness. So how do you describe the book? Because I'm sure all these critics have all these fancy labels that they throw at it, and publishing press releases say that it's this. But what is it to you? Because some of the words in it, it's very, very deeply poetic.
So for me, it's I just hope that it's really a good book. I mean, that's really all I try to do, you know. That's all I try to do is write something that's good and moving. The rest of it is not, I mean, it's important to me, you know. I'm glad people respond to it, but, you know, how they respond to it is, it doesn't really matter to me, you know. But if they find it moving and good, that's, you know, that's good enough for me.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. The English philosopher and political theorist John Locke is celebrated as the father of modern liberalism, and his iconic texts are seen as central to the American Enlightenment canon and to contemporary political thought. However, what's interesting in Locke's story is how some of his ideas on freedom, religious toleration, and government have been misappropriated by both the American right and left. So with that in mind, and given a particularly shaky political start to 2017, what with Brexit, Donald Trump, Putin, and all the other players hanging tough,
We're going to explore John Locke's place in intellectual history and see how some of his writings and political philosophies have influenced modern theories of revolution and governance, and where we are today.
My name is Mark Goldie, and I'm in Cambridge. I've taught here for quite a long time. As an academic, I guess I'm a bit of a crossbreed because I'm mainly a historian, but because I'm interested in the history of ideas, I kind of cross over between history and politics and history and philosophy. And it's really fun working in that interdisciplinary way. So I often, for example, go to conferences of political theorists, but I might go to a conference of historians too. So what I'm really interested in is what people thought in the past. What was their thought world? How is it similar to ours? How is it different? How can we reconstruct different patterns of outlook and belief and value and philosophy in the past? And I guess I spent a lot of years thinking about that and writing about that, mainly in the 17th, 18th century, at a time when I tend to think of Britain as having an extremely troubled period before it decided to settle down. Time of civil war and revolution, and enormously fruitful in terms of the kinds of political arguments and theories that were that spun out of that.
Well, in a time of political turbulence, Mark, what a joy it was to read your latest book on John Locke. Very interesting introduction to yourselves, I might add, describing yourself as a crossbreed. It positions you very nicely and in a very interesting place. And with that in mind, I might throw you a big wide open question, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Locke once said that all men are liable to error, and most men are on many points by passion or interest under temptation to it. I'm just wondering if it's not too cheeky to ask you, can we apply that to Locke himself?
Well, we certainly can, but I'm going to cheat on the question a bit and just explore a little bit what he meant by that, because it seems to me you could almost divide people in the history of political thought into two camps. And I'm thinking here of a long, long tradition of thinking about politics, about the state, about big questions like what's justice and what makes a state legitimate, and so on. I think there's one sort that tends toward a utopian optimism, a hopefulness, that almost wants to forget about error, or what Christians would call sin, the fact that human beings are self-interested, they suffer from cupidity, to use a fancy word for it, and that they're bound to end up in conflict with each other. And then there's the other sort, who are more pessimistic, some would say more reasonable or more realistic in their view of human nature. And they would say that in politics and in life, you have to work with the grain of human error. Again, to use a kind of fancy bit of theology here, it would be Augustinian, or, you know, St. Augustine's deep sense of human sin. We are all capable and will commit error. We will disagree. We will fight for what we want. And somehow the problem of politics is how you handle that kind of rather depressing vision of human nature.
And I would imagine that in the rough and tumble of political life, it's in error that we learn, isn't it?
It is. Or rather, what mechanisms do you put in place to try and minimise error or to cope with error? Locke was not a utopian. I think he had certain kinds of optimism, and he certainly thought that one could and should attempt to construct a fair and just society, or aim and approximate to that. But he always knew that there are, I think, two fundamentals about any state. A state has to be coercive. There are times when it's going to have to use force to bring people into line or to protect you from your enemies. And it's also going to have to be a kind of referee and umpire between the conflicts that are among us. Conflicts of property, conflicts of religion, conflicts of ideas, conflicts of interests.
He was a great believer in the law, wasn't he? He thought that the law almost, if we enforced these laws and developed different types of laws, that we became almost free.
That's a very interesting point you made about law making us almost free. And I'll just come back to that in a second. But I think the more basic idea is that law is absolutely fundamental to his conception of a state. He's not describing, as I said, he's not a utopian describing some kind of perfect or harmonious community. And he wants to say that government is not like a family, government is not like a religion. Those are all other things we do in life. Government has quite specific purposes. And the making of the law, making laws that apply equally and fairly to all, is fundamental to what government does. And one further key thing about law is, for him, and I think this is right, it's the opposite of arbitrariness. What tyranny is having to live under the whim of someone, someone who snaps their fingers and says, do this, do that, or off with his head, or whatever, where you don't have autonomy, you don't have the freedom to make your own decisions, be your own agent. And it's law, precisely because law is abstract, general, is meant to apply equally and fairly to everyone, that allows us to escape the arbitrariness of whimsical rulers. So the rule of law is absolutely fundamental. But you've hit on a very interesting point and a really big debate in political theory and among all of us now and at any time is law to be seen as a restriction of our freedom or does it create the foundations of our freedom? Now, if you took the first view, you could say, well, of course law restricts our freedom because it tells us to do something that we might not want to do. But you could say, well, that's just a fair trade-off. I know I will benefit from a law-governed society, so I'm prepared to, as it were, trade in bits of my liberty in order to gain security. But I think there's a more subtle or almost more philosophical view in someone like Locke or Rousseau. They would actually argue that you don't really live in a place of free agency, of free people, without a basis and foundation of law, that law is a kind of creative agency, that government actually helps and serves us in creating an environment or a set of institutions that allow us to pursue a fuller and freer life.
But within all of that, Mark, it depends if the institutions are working or not.
Of course. And Locke, in fact, wrote his book at a time when he profoundly believed that the institutions weren't working, that he was living under a tyranny, because he spent his life in the 17th century under the Royal House of Stuart. And Locke is, well, really the leading philosopher who argues that if there is tyranny, if your monarch or your government, of whatever sort it is, has turned into a despotism, then in the last resort, we the people have the right to take up arms. And that really lays a foundation for modern revolutionary theory that we've been picked up all the way through.
Now, Mark, in your instructions, you argue that John Locke is one of the most misunderstood and misquoted philosophers. And I think you mentioned that both the American right and left have claimed him for their own. It's very, very interesting because he is kind of slippery to interpret, isn't he? And some of his views, whether it's on property, on slavery, they're not clear cut.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I suppose it's a feature of the best philosophers that they are quite slippery because they acquire such fame. They become kind of icons. I guess a lot of people haven't heard of Locke, though I must say a lot of Americans have. It's odd that, although he was an Englishman, because Americans believe he was a kind of honorary founding father and such an influence on the American Declaration of Rights and the American Revolution, you know, school kids in America learn about him. So he's got a very big reputation. And with any iconic figure in politics or in any other sphere of life, people want to invoke the name and want their authority on their side. And if you start Googling and going on the web and see who is quoting Locke, you will find him being pulled about, if you like, and used in all sorts of ways. One of the interesting things is that I think his reputation has become very divided. Some people revere him as a kind of almost secular saint, particularly American right-wing defenders of the absolute free market, haters of the state who think the state is always the enemy of freedom, who think Locke's their man and quote him no end. And on the other hand, there are quite a lot of people who are very suspicious of Locke because they think that although he's proclaimed as a liberal, in fact, his argument and his period of time led to or was involved with the building of the British Empire and all its racial superiority. There are those feminists who'd want to say that his freedom of man is precisely that. It's a freedom for males. So there's quite a lot of criticism of it. And interestingly, there's a new kind of critique of people like Locke. Some religiously committed people want to say that Locke's push towards a secular society is an anti-Christian one. It's not neutral to religion. It's actually anti-Christian or anti-religious.
What do you think Locke would make of ISIS? Because it's if we look at what you've just published, John Locke's Second Treaty of Government and a Letter Concerning Toleration, he does argue space for different views.
He certainly does. One of his most important works, and one which is getting a lot more attention now for fairly obvious reasons, is a little book called A Letter on Toleration. It's only really essay length, and it's absolutely fundamental text in trying to wean European society off inquisitions, persecutions, and religious wars. And it's easy for us now to forget the centuries in which Christianity was at war with itself, whether in the suppression of heresy within states or in wars of religion between states. Christianity in its various forms was extremely toxic. And people like Locke were trying to argue a case for saying that states, political societies, should be tolerant of religion. And his is a classic text that argues that. But then we come to the slipperiness, or we come to the difficult crunch of what and where are the limits of that. Now, Locke is quite clear that whatever your beliefs, or whether you have very little belief, or whether you're Jewish or Muslim or Christian or whatever, then the state has no business poking into your beliefs and your practice and your worship. But the only ground on which the state can interfere is to protect individuals, the citizens of the state. And, of course, it is true that sometimes religious beliefs license in various kinds of fanaticism, and this is can be as true of Christianity or any religion, various kinds of fanaticism, which, of course, the state must suppress. Since we all focus on ISIS, let me just give you a little example from Christian religion. There have been one or two cases in the United States where very deeply committed Christians have murdered abortion doctors. They believe that they are doing God's work in doing so. But of course, the state and the political society, civil society, holds that that is murder. And it's no good pleading your religious conscience in that case, because the state will step in and say, we'll draw the line there. So any time a religion produces a principle that fundamentally violates the principles of a civil society, then the state will want to step in.
How do you explain his position on atheists? You know, he was all for religious toleration, but he felt that, you know, that atheists were a threat to society, that they would undermine social order in some way, that we'd have chaos. That's a bit over the top, isn't it?
Well, it's not over the top in the 17th century, but of course today it would seem so. And there are people in his time, like the great Dutch philosopher Spinoza or Pierre Bayle, the Frenchman, who were prepared to argue that toleration must extend to atheism. I agree it's very puzzling in Locke, and it brings us to the fact that he's clearly a Christian, certainly a very liberal Christian, liberal Protestant Christian by the standards of his time, but he has deep religious commitments, and standing behind his secular sounding vocabulary of rights and equality and consent, which of course is a vocabulary we use in the modern liberal world without necessarily a religious background. But the bottom line for him was that we are God's creatures. And for example, he denied that we were entitled to commit suicide because that's to destroy what God has made. And he did hold a view that atheists somehow couldn't or wouldn't uphold the fundamental ethics that makes society sustainable. I agree it's very hard for us to get our heads around that now.
But it just doesn't seem to sit with some of his other views. I was interested that you wrote that Locke is somewhat lucky, or how he's been interpreted. And you say, after the fall of the Soviet communism, a journalist wrote that the Cold War had been about whether John Locke or Karl Marx was right.
Yes. What I mean by lucky is that one might think that a political or any other kind of philosopher or great thinker will reach a big status and become famous just because of the quality of their thought. And of course, there's a lot of truth in that. You know, Plato will always be with us after 2,500 years because he was a very profound philosopher. But I think there's an element of luck and circumstance in who becomes famous and why. The fact that Locke was taken up by the American revolutionaries certainly gave him a lot of status. And he is now cast in the role of being the philosopher of liberalism. There are plenty of other possible candidates for that, but he gets to be, as it were, the summary figure, the one figure you cite as the great founder of modern liberalism. which is partly why there's so much argument about him. I think in relation to that remark about the Cold War being Karl Marx versus John Locke, well, that has, of course, to do with Western concepts of liberty and freedom, but it also particularly has to do with Western capitalist concepts of the market. And it draws attention to his very famous discussion of property. And I think one reason why he is so much discussed now is that he did write about property. And all of our modern politics is very much about property and the economy. And this is an area where, again, he's slippery and hard to interpret. Is he simply a defender of private property against all comers? Or does he have an element where he wants to say that the common good through government and the law is entitled to restrict private property?
So, Mark, let me throw you a bit of luck on property and maybe you figure it out what he really means. Where there is no property, there is no injustice. Or Locke also says, government has no other end but the preservation of property.
Yes, yeah. Well, the second quote sounds very restrictive, doesn't it? That political society only exists to protect property. But he was careful to say that we have property in our person, our self, our labour, as well as the objects and things we own. So I think he's thinking of property in the whole self. The function of government is simply the protection of persons and their rights, their ownership of their rights. So it's not just about goods or land or money. But there's no doubt that he does think that goods and land and money matter. And he was putting an argument for the rights of private property, partly against utopian communists of his own time. And there were lots of communists, well, there were some communists long before Karl Marx, people who thought that God gave the world to mankind in common. And on the other hand, he wanted to challenge defenders of divine right monarchy who said, well, the king can take your money when he feels like it. So it's a defense of private property against absolute states and also against communism.
Well, what about the idea of people as property? Because he thought that slavery could be justified on the grounds of empire and expansion. And he brought it down to his concept, his approach to agriculture and agricultural production, didn't he?
This, again, you've hit on something that a lot of people argue about. And there's quite interesting debates now about Locke's relationship, particularly to America and the development of colonial empires in America. He does, it's true, put an emphasis upon agriculture. And there's a kind of beginnings, if you like, of an argument about historical evolution, of the society's move towards more advanced forms, and that settled agriculture is a more advanced form than hunter-gatherers. And that seems to apply in the colonial context to an exclusion of native peoples and justifying the rights of settlers. His view was that there were indeed wide open spaces in America and that we have a fundamental duty and right to dig the land. So he certainly backed colonial development. I don't myself think there's anything racist in the modern sense. I don't think he had a theory of natural difference between races or peoples, but he certainly did put the emphasis upon cultivation and agriculture as being the way in which we make the world fruitful.
How does that sit with you? You know, you've written extensively on a lot of different interesting thinkers through history. Does that not sit uncomfortably with you? You can probably see where he's going with it all. But at the same time, it's quite uncomfortable, isn't it?
I think it is from our perspectives. But I think in the first place, we shouldn't be spending our time taking the high moral ground now and condemning people in the past who lived in different value systems. One thing I like to say when people start condemning someone like Locke as defending imperialism or colonialism or capitalism, I say, okay, but do you know who made the trainers you're wearing and the T-shirt you're wearing and where they were made and how much the makers were paid? You know, we all live in very complicated economies and societies, and we're not all morally perfect ourselves. And the other thing I like to say to people who are so ready to condemn philosophers in the past is try the little act of imagination and imagining in 100 years' time the ways in which people will look back on us and say, well, they thought they were civilized and ethical and committed to equality and fairness, but They did this, they did that. They were terrible to their environment. They tolerated all sorts of things. My favorite example is tolerance of death on the roads. I think that in 100 years' time, we will be condemned as a society for being incredibly casual about the tolerance of road death. So my general point is that I think it's terribly easy to take the moral high ground in the here and now and condemn past thinkers and past people. It's a kind of assumption that you know, we're morally pure, morally right. And I think we're going to look pretty mixed up in a century's time ourselves.
So we have to think a bit more spaciously, is that it?
I think so. I think we have to be a bit relativist about it.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I'm just wondering, he wrote also about a philosophy of the self, and he had lots of different ideas on truth and what it all means. How do you understand his ideas on the self?
Well, if you go to a philosophy department, they'll be reading a different book. He wrote a very big book about knowledge and what human beings know and don't know. An Essay Concerning Human Understanding is what it's called. So he's an enormously productive writer on many different fields. His philosophy there is often summed up in the one word empiricism, that we should restrict our knowledge to what is provable, demonstrable, discoverable. I guess that's a sensible core of it. I think in a way the effect of this on how we think about society and people goes back to your very first interesting point about error. Sometimes his book is regarded as being a manifesto for ever-expanding knowledge, particularly scientific knowledge. But actually, I think he's quite skeptical and cautious. He wants to keep telling us, well, there are all sorts of things we don't know that we can't be sure of. He's a critic of overconfidence about what we know, because he's very fearful that it's overconfident people who think they know who produce the tyrannies in this world. They know that this or that form of Christianity is right and therefore impose it on others and so on.
One final question for you, Mark. He's obviously the prophet of the American and French Revolution. He's influenced everyone from Voltaire to Jefferson. He's so many different types of original thinkers. I'm just wondering, what do you see as his place in intellectual history?
I think he's one of the half dozen really serious thinkers about politics and civil society and the kind of state or government we want to set up. We'd put him alongside Plato or Rousseau or John Stuart Mill. There's only half a dozen that I think that really deserve our close attention. Do you mind finally if I just give you a couple of quotations from your own Irish constitution, which I think is in many ways a very Lockean document? Just a couple of quick quotations. First article. The Irish nation affirms the inalienable sovereign right to choose its own form of government. That's the classical tradition. Obviously, Locke's not the only source of that, but it's the sort of language of Locke. Or again, Article 6, all powers of government under God from the people. The people are the only source of legitimate government, the consent of the people. And Article 43 on property actually sums up that tension or contradiction or difficulty that I expressed before. Because on the one hand, the Irish Constitution says that everyone has a natural right before there is government. In other words, it belongs to you naturally, to private property, private ownership. But then it goes on to say we can, in some circumstance, delimit that if required by social justice and the common good. And of course, like all constitutions, it doesn't sort out how on earth that's to pan out in detail. But that does sum up exactly the sort of tension and principle that Locke is exploring when he discusses property.
But I wonder, are we living through those ideals, Mark?
They're not so much they are ideals. They're guiding criteria. Politics is messy. Governments don't live up to expectations. But here's what someone like Locke's trying to do is to set down a set of criteria, principles that should help shape the laws and the principles that we want to put in place when we try to sit down amongst all our disputes and conflicts and get along together in political society.
And that was Professor Mark Goldie. John Locke, Second Treaties of Government, and a Letter Concerning Toleration is published by Oxford World Classic Series and is available in paperback for just under €11. Terrific reading for anyone interested in the origins of modern liberalism and where it's gone wrong. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the thought-provoking words from Paul Beatty from The Sellout. You've got to ask yourself two questions. Who am I? And how I may become myself. Yep, he's got it. Good night.